Well, good afternoon, good evening, early evening, everyone. I'm Catherine McCarter. I'm the Executive Director of the Ecological Society of America, and it is my distinct pleasure and really an honor to welcome you here today to the 95th annual meeting of ESA and to this really exciting city of Pittsburgh and this wonderfully green convention center. The theme of this year's meeting is Global Warming, the Legacy of the Past, and the challenge for our future. We have a plenary session this evening that we think is going to provide an excellent kickoff to the meeting. First, ESA's Regional Policy Award will be given to a Pennsylvania mayor with a commitment to sustainability and a mayor who has devised innovative ways to revitalize his town by encouraging green technology, including wind power. In addition, the ongoing dialogue on global warming has made the scientific community keenly aware of the multiple factors that shape our perception of risk and how that perception can shape society's response. We have a distinguished group of panelists tonight that will be broadly examining the issue of how society perceives and responds to environmental risks. We think this plenary is going to help inform your discussions this week as you explore the theme of global warming and as you prepare to address the challenges of the future. On behalf of everyone who was involved at the 95th annual meeting of ESA, I hope that you will find tonight's session and this week's program informative and stimulating. And it's now my pleasure to turn the podium over to Mary Power, ESA's president, who will preside over this session. Welcome to our meeting.
Thank you very much, Catherine, and welcome all to the 95th Ecological Society of America meeting. And my first pleasure and duty is to turn to the Ecological Society of America's Regional Policy Award. We established this award in 2008, and it recognizes a local or regional policymaker with an outstanding record of informing policy decisions with ecological science. And this year, we're very proud to present the award to Mayor John Fetterman of Braddock, Pennsylvania. Mayor Braddock is the mayor of a suburb of Pittsburgh, Braddock. Steel Baron Andrew Carnegie put his first mill in this town, and he also built his first library there. But the steel industry declined in the 1970s, and so did this once prosperous town. Braddock lost most of its residents and experienced rising crime. Mayor Fetterman is working to revitalize Braddock by positioning it to be a leader in green development. Emphasizing sustainability, Mayor Fetterman has shown how social environmental initiatives can work together synergistically. Since he was elected in 2005, Mayor Fetterman has initiated youth and art programs, created a community center, and worked to rebuild the town's buildings and economy. He has encouraged the development of urban farms on empty lots. He's encouraged environmentally friendly building design, and he's persuaded an alternative energy company to secure a warehouse in Braddock. Mayor Fetterman believes that green energy can revitalize the region's economy, and he has been involved in the Environmental Defense Fund's advocacy for carbon caps and green technology. Recent climate change discussions in the U.S. Congress demonstrate the significant role that economic concerns play in environmental policy. Mayor Fetterman's vision is that these can be complementary goals. For example, if the nation moves towards using more wind power as one of its energy sources, this demand will create jobs at steel mills to manufacture windmill components. Mayor Fetterman's strong emphasis on sustainability, environmental justice, and his committed and innovative approach to green urban renewal is a tremendous inspiration. We are very pleased that he is able to join us this evening to accept ESA's Regional Policy Award in person. And please join me in welcoming Mayor Fetterman. Would you like to make a few remarks? Yes, please.
you guys probably thought I was a washed up professional wrestler. The word suburb kind of gives the wrong meaning of what Braddock is. Braddock is a small town which was once populated by over 20,000 residents, and now we're under 3,000, so that's nearly a 90% loss of our population. Consequently, 90% of our town's in a landfill somewhere. You know, the buildings are gone, the homes are gone, businesses are gone. So it's probably the most dramatic implosion of an American city that at least I'm aware of in terms of what was left. So we're really kind of starting at a very low base level here where, you know, what does green mean? Well, for us, green means as a food desert that we started urban farming, and it also creates summer jobs for our young people. It means saving the buildings that we have, given that 9 out of 10 of them are gone and the remaining 10% are in struggling condition. It also means being part of a bigger project, a more regional project, which I hope some of you, if you have some free time in the interest, would like to wander around an abandoned steel mill right on the Braddock border in the Mon Valley, which is being repurposed through the help of the direction of Dan Honorato, our chief executive, to be really the largest green enterprise zone in the state. It's an incredibly beautiful site, and if anyone's interested, please contact either me or the Rivers of Steel group, and they'd be happy to give you a guided tour some afternoon, depending on how long you're in town. So I don't presume that most of you probably aren't from the Pittsburgh area, so given it's hard to describe Braddock without some pictures, so I didn't bring any. However, suffice to say, you know, we have our work cut out for us. As a community that's struggling, I have always tried to be a good example without kind of getting caught up in the politics of it, because I think that's the one thing that's hurting more than anything, is that I don't presume to know where everyone, you know, leans left or right. However, if, let's say, you know, if Al Gore is a main messenger for global warming, that turns off more than half the population in terms of the politically conservative. I think we have to move past that. Just as if you're left-leaning and Glenn Beck was championing a cause, I know at least myself, I'd have some resistance, you know, to embracing that message as well. So, and that's why I was honored to participate in the Environmental Defense Fund's ads to hope to pass meaningful climate legislation. It makes sense for the communities like Braddock, because we really believe that environmental justice is social justice. One of every four children in our community suffers from asthma, and it's the poorest community in Allegheny County, which comprises about 1.2 million residents. You know, we'll never be able to build a green convention center and bring you all out to town in the way you are here tonight. However, if anything, the takeaway message, what happened in Braddock and what's happening in Braddock, is that green is meaningful and green is important for any community, whether you're Portland, Oregon, or whether you're San Francisco, or you're the poorest community in a region overall that's struggling economically like Braddock. So it's a great honor to be here. I just can't imagine why I'm here, but it's an honor to receive this honor for Braddock, and I can't thank everybody enough. And I just want to introduce my son Carl, if he's making some noise. And my wife, Giselle, and it's a real pleasure, and welcome to Pittsburgh. And honestly, if anyone's interested in a tour of the Cary Furnace site, which is, again, that abandoned steel mill, you know, please let me know, and we're happy to arrange one. So thank you very much for this great honor.
So it's a great pleasure to give the ESA Regional Policy Award to Mayor John Braddock. And thank you for your work, sir. Fetterman, sorry, of Braddock.
I wish my last name was Braddock. Really.
Thank you. So I will now turn the stage over to ESA's Vice President for Public Affairs, who is also the Vice President for Research at the Northern Arizona University, Laura Henneke, and she will introduce the panel that she's assembled for tonight and moderate the subsequent discussion.
Well, thank you. Thank you, everyone, for coming to our opening plenary and the first formal session of this year's annual meeting of ESA. These opening plenaries have been important opportunities for the society to recognize that the science that we've come here to talk about throughout the following week is really rooted in a larger social, political, human context, and the Regional Policy Award is one of the more recent innovations of the society, and despite what Mayor Fetterman said, I think we all recognize why he's here, why it's important to us to acknowledge that there's really crucial work going on in the policy arena that provides an important, compelling context for the science that we're doing. Now, the opening plenaries of the last several years have been highlighting single keynote speakers, and we've taken a very different approach to organizing this year's plenary. Rather than a single speaker, we have assembled a panel here who are going to help us think through a crucial question that's highly relevant to the theme of the meeting, global warming, but also to so many of the events of the last few years, including this summer's Deep Horizon oil spill. That question is, why is it that society is so often in reactive mode rather than proactive mode when it comes to these risks of high-impact environmental events or tragedies? Why is it so difficult for us as scientists to communicate about these risks, and why is it so difficult for society to judge those risks and to prepare for them? To get into planning or mitigation mode rather than just waiting around until something happens and then be in reactive mode. Catastrophic fires, oil spills, storm damage, climate change, the big issue. Why is it that we're stuck in this reactive mode? So we've assembled these four panelists to help us consider this question. They'll be each taking a very brief period of time to talk about their perspective and their history on this question. And then at the conclusion of those four short presentations, then they'll have about 20 minutes to speak and engage each other and to follow up on the points that each other have made. And then we hope that that leaves about 15 minutes at the end. We've got a microphone here for engagement with you, the audience, the questions that are raised in your minds and the reactions that you have to the points we have here today. In the order in which they'll be making their initial comments, I'd like to introduce all four of them now. First, David Dzombach from here in Pittsburgh at Carnegie Mellon, where he's the Walter Blanco Senior University Professor of Civil and Environmental Engineering. He also serves as the faculty director of the Steinbrenner Institute for Environmental Education and Research. Next, we'll have David Lodge from the Department of Biological Sciences at Notre Dame, where he's the director of the Center for Aquatic Conservation and is focused on risks of aquatic biological invasions. Third, we'll have Robert Twilley, who is Associate Vice Chancellor for Research at Louisiana State University, and he's director of the Coastal Systems and Society Initiative. Finally, we'll have Baruch Fischhoff, again from Carnegie Mellon here in Pittsburgh, where he is the Howard Hines University Professor and has appointments in two departments, Social and Decision Sciences and Engineering and Public Policy. And he is head of the decision sciences major there to give us some more general perspectives on human and societal perceptions of risk. So I'd like to start off with David. They'll each take 5 minutes. As your 5 minutes is winding to a close, I'll move from my inconspicuous post in the back up here to the podium to introduce the next person. And then as we've concluded each of those sequence of presentations, then we'll open it up for them to engage each other. David?
Thank you, Laura. Well, first, let me welcome you all to Pittsburgh. It's a pleasure for me to be here and to have all of you in Pittsburgh. The panel's asked to talk about responses to environmental disasters. I'm going to be talking about the EPA response to contamination following Hurricane Katrina. When Hurricane Katrina flooded the city of New Orleans in 2005, one of many concerns in its wake was contamination. There were several chemical plants, petroleum refining facilities, contaminated sites covered by floodwaters, and in addition, there were hundreds of commercial establishments with hazardous materials on sites, such as gasoline stations, pest control businesses, dry cleaners, et cetera, all flooded. The city sewage system was inundated, resulting in raw sewage mixing in with the floodwaters. And so contamination of the floodwater with chemical and biological agents was quickly a concern. There was also concern about contamination that would be left behind in deposited sediments and in soils as the floodwater receded. Federal agencies, especially the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency and the National Oceanographic and Atmospheric Administration, were called upon for rapid assessment of contamination and associated risk to emergency workers and residents. EPA Region 6, which covers the New Orleans region and is based in Dallas, led the response efforts on behalf of EPA. The EPA Science Advisory Board was asked to provide rapid peer review of sampling plans developed, and I was asked to chair the committee that reviewed the sediment sampling plan. There was a lot of interest in this because of sediment deposits in homes and on private properties and issues about when they could be reoccupied. Another SAB committee was organized to review the water sampling plan. The storm hit August 29th. The SAB was pressed into service on September 3rd. We reviewed the sampling plans very quickly and held a meeting of a committee organized quickly to review the sediment sampling plan on September 13th. This is very rapid work for the SAB. EPA Region 6 certainly worked hard and was responsive to the contamination evaluation challenge. The EPA collected and analyzed over 400 sediment samples between September 10 and October 14. The agency also collected many more water and soil samples. Yet it was clear from the sediment and water sampling plans that the SAB reviewed that these plans were quite ad hoc and that there was little pre-planning for such an event. This surprised and concerned the SAB reviewers. In late October 2005, I convened a group of SAB members who had served on the water and sediment sampling plan reviews to discuss the issue of EPA preparedness for responding to environmental disaster from the lens of our experience with the sampling plans. Some of the specific problems we identified were the sampling plans did not specify objectives. Many of the analytes listed were not appropriate for immediate response assessment and rather were focused on chronic risk chemicals. These were lists of chemicals pulled out of the Superfund program. The plans were lacking in attention to microbiological contaminants, and there were other concerns. Our group prepared a letter to the SAB leadership stating our view that the EPA needs to be better prepared to respond to disasters by developing some standard basic sampling plans appropriate for different stages of response. The immediate response, where the question is, are the responders safe? Over the intermediate term, to answer questions like, can the evacuees come back and reoccupy their homes? In the longer term, to answer questions such as, is there unacceptable contamination of soils and yards in public areas? We recommended the SAB encourage and work with the agency to develop improved plans for disaster response. Subsequently, the SAB undertook a self-initiated study of the state of EPA's preparedness for response to environmental disasters. And in the course of this study, the SAB received briefings from numerous agencies, companies, and other organizations. Primary motivation for this effort was to help EPA become less reactive and more anticipatory. A report was completed in October 2008 and submitted to the EPA administrator. You can find that by Googling EPA SAB environmental disasters, and it'll come right up. Some main messages from that report are that while EPA's statutory responsibilities in environmental disaster situations are limited, at the same time, the general public will look at the agency's name and expect it to take a wider range of responsibilities. And so it's very much in the agency's interest to assure that preparations for possible future environmental disasters have been well developed and that there are not gaps in responsibility or response. The statement, you know, not in my department, just doesn't go very well when you're in the middle of a disaster. It was recommended the EPA establish a small interdisciplinary environmental disaster assessment team charged with identifying, prioritizing, and assessing potential environmental disasters, natural and man-made. The team should perform or arrange for others to perform comprehensive assessments of these disasters deemed to be of greatest concern. And the team should look at gaps in coverage by federal, state, and local authorities and the needs for improved coverage, coordination, and pre-planning. In short, EPA was encouraged to take more of a leadership role and to be anticipatory in response to environmental disasters. The agency continues to work on this in coordination with the Department of Homeland Security and other agencies, making progress, but there's a long way to go yet. Thank you.
Thanks, David. Next, we'll have David Lodge.
My comments tonight are going to be about a biological invasion, an invasion that I think is unfortunately representative of thousands of other biological invasions on the planet. So while I'm going to focus on one invasion, I think there are many lessons and perspectives to be gained on many other invasions. The particular invasion I'm going to talk about is that by harmful Asian carp, two species which are moving toward and possibly already into the Laurentian Great Lakes, international water bodies between Canada and the U.S. The fish are moving through an artificial Chicago area waterway. The things at risk are many ecosystem services in the Great Lakes, particularly the $7 billion annual fishery, which would be at least in part threatened should either of these species become established in the Great Lakes, and very valuable recreational activities, and indeed regional identity of the some 40 million people or more who live along the Great Lakes. Before I tell you a little bit more about these, this particular invasion, though, I need to give you a little background, a little setting about how human activities have set the table for this invasion as it's playing out now. About 1900, the city of Chicago reversed the flow of the Chicago River and other natural waterways in the Chicago region through a network of canals. This was done so that Chicagoans could flush their collective toilet down the Illinois River instead of into Lake Michigan, which is their source of drinking water. Never mind the folks in St. Louis. So hence, this canal in the Chicago area connected in 1900 two of the great independent watersheds of North America, the Mississippi River and the Great Lake St. Lawrence watersheds. Now, after the water quality in this canal improved dramatically following on the passage of the Clean Water Act, the waterway became a highway, an aquatic highway for dispersal of many species, including some high-profile ones from previous decades, like the round goby and zebra and quagga mussels, which have now, after traversing the canal, found their way to California. It's a two-way highway to havoc, havoc for ecosystem services and human welfare. So now let me sort of fast forward to the last 9 months of activity and increased knowledge and awareness and management action on in the Chicago area waterway in response particularly to two species of Asian carp, silver carp and bighead carp, both of which were introduced, imported into the United States and introduced into fish ponds in Arkansas in the mid-1970s to control nuisance phytoplankton blooms in catfish ponds. Since the early 1980s, however, it has been widely known that both species had escaped, of course, and both species were dispersing and reproducing their way northward in the Mississippi River, the Illinois River, the Missouri River, and many of their tributaries. Now, in the last year, working with Drs. Chris Jurdy and Andy Mahon at Notre Dame and with Lindsay Chatterton of the Nature Conservancy, we have applied environmental DNA monitoring to better locate the invasion front. Using this tool, which is much more sensitive than the traditional sampling tools of, say, netting and electrofishing, we have unfortunately discovered that the invasion front of these of both of these species is many tens of miles north of where it was previously thought to be. And more unfortunately than that, the invasion front is north of electric barriers on which the Army Corps of Engineers has spent roughly $20 million in the last few, since about 2000. These electric barriers were meant to prevent fish from traversing the canal. With the release of our results over the last 9 months, this sort of slow, previously recognized, this slow, steady burn, if you will, of dispersal northward has quickly become a raging conflagration. With much press coverage, public concern, management activity, congressional hearings, the White House CEQ framework plan for the management of Asian carps, and many lawsuits. Now, given the constraints of time, let me just finish by offering a list of six perspectives, very briefly, that are relevant to this and I think many other invasions. First, technologies and practices, the sorts of things that we scientists invent and apply, can improve early detection of species, and that can change the perception of risk and the willingness of the public to respond. Two, one of the continuing reasons for inadequate responses to this and many other invasions is that those people who are most at risk, probably those who depend on the Lake Erie ecosystem, are at a great geographic distance from the initial point of harm, that is, southern Lake Michigan, where these fishes have access to the Great Lakes. Third, if one or both of these Asian carps become established in the Great Lakes, the damages won't fully develop for years, if not decades. Given human nature, it's very difficult. That time lag makes it very difficult for the public and agencies to maintain a sense of short-term urgency that is commensurate with the long-term risk. Four, likewise, the damages and potential damages posed by these carps and many other invasive species tend to be spread thinly across society, while the benefits of importing potentially harmful species are concentrated, of course, in the industries that import them. This asymmetry in per capita risk translates into an asymmetry of political power, despite the large net negative impact of invasive species on society as a whole. Fifth, recent knowledge and improved scientific risk assessments now exist which could inform policies to prevent the future importation of other harmful species. But Congress has so far not responded adequately and importations and invasions continue. Finally, despite widespread knowledge of the plethora of potentially harmful species moving north to south and south to north in the Chicago area canal, the press, the public, policymakers, natural resource managers, all have continued to focus on one species at a time. The magnitude and confidence, however, with which we can estimate risk increases and the timeline of risk decreases the more species one considers. And the probability of management response increases with the magnitude and proximity of the risk. What I'm trying to say is, if we focused more on the pathways and the collective risk of the species that move in a single pathway, our risk management would probably be more commensurate with the risk assessments. So I hope we can pursue some of these points in discussion. Thank you.
Thanks, David. Robert Twilley.
Thanks. I'm going to talk about the challenges to the Gulf Coast, and I guess that the theme of my comments are basically a statement that the challenges facing the Gulf Coast reflect a national inability to come to grips with the need to deal with neglected infrastructure, both natural and built. And what I want to emphasize in my comments that neglect of really understanding the dynamic between built and natural infrastructure usually occurs right after a crisis. And I'll use some examples of the Gulf Coast to demonstrate this. I refer to this now from my perspective as what I call calibrating our consequences. And it's by calibrating our consequences and really being able to put a value on true risk of the trade-offs that we make following a crisis between decisions we make related to built engineered infrastructure, which is driven mainly for public safety, versus natural landscape infrastructure, which its services are not usually part of the formula that goes into that analysis, and is where I think we have failed or at least been a cause of the consequences we face today. And what I want to argue is that it's our inability at the national level and also at the state level to deal with this conflict between built and natural infrastructure following crisis that actually leads us into myopia relative to dealing with, I think, events that we're now seeing in the Gulf Coast, which could play out in other coastal communities across the U.S. in the future. Coastal Louisiana has always been a landscape of risk. It's a very dynamic Delta Coast. It's the eighth largest river in the world. Floods in the 1800s, of course, impeded the economic development of this nation because of its conflict with navigation. The flood of 1927 prompted one of the most famous national responses to risk, flood risk, and that was the Mississippi River and Tributary Act, which resulted in an entire levee system along the Mississippi River, which, as we all know, shut off the Mississippi mud and sediment and to the wetlands of the Delta. And over the last 100 years, that's resulted in about 1.3 million acres of wetland loss. Now, what I find intriguing in that history is the fact that now, today, we reflect on that as calling it unintended consequences for the good of the nation to drive the economic needs, again, because of the influence of navigation. But I can tell you that there was a report delivered to the state legislature by Paul Octave Hebert, who clearly said that as you cut off the various channels of the Mississippi River to the wetlands, you will see a decline of the Mississippi River Delta. That report was delivered in 1879. The Ecological Society of America also plays a really key role in this history. That in 1928, Percy Viasca published in a journal, Ecology, that if the Mississippi River had policies that are maintained to disconnect the river from the wetlands of the Mississippi River Delta, that you will see a decline of those natural resources, which that experiment has played out, and that hypothesis has been proven today. The key is if we know that this was going to be something that was going to occur, the science was there, the policy didn't follow because of the economic engine, and the true validation and calibrating of the consequences of what those actions would be is essentially was non-existent to change those policy conditions. Then along comes Hurricane Katrina, which validated the vulnerability of this coastal landscape to exactly what those people said in 1879 and 1928, that the decline of the natural resources of that region would amplify the complications to risk, and we saw that, as everyone knows, from Hurricane Katrina. So what I will argue again is that it's during this reorganization phase, as all ecologists, we know that reorganization phase following disturbance, that it's that conflict between decisions that are made in engineered landscapes for public safety versus the consequences of natural landscapes that aren't accounted for until years later, until the next crisis, do you actually see the implications of the short-term policies following the crisis. So four hurricanes in 2005 and again the oil gusher that we're seeing today, the sand berms that we're trying to build at the last minute, you know, if we had the barrier island system that was there, that was part of a natural functioning river, if we had controlled floods instead of flood control, all of those features of the landscape would be there protecting things that we're trying to build now during a crisis. Those would have been natural landscapes that would have been there to protect. So I have three things that I want to suggest that needs to be considered to correct this. One is finding solutions. As a society and as a part of the science community, you know, I always tell my students that, you know, we're very good at diagnostics. We're horrible at prescription. It really is getting down in there and finding solutions and putting things on the table and figuring out what needs to be done with the new things like what the Dutch are doing, which is, we all know, first principles such as ecological engineering instead of strictly civil engineering, and designing with nature and finding different ways. And these are playing out in landscapes around the world. And also that we have to have the natural resources of these landscapes that are so critical to actually providing value to public safety. And we have to do this in changed environments that actually add constraints, because one story in the Gulf Coast that's critical right now is that while we talk about we need sediment, we need to put the river back into the wetlands, we need to put those wetlands or connect those wetlands to the river and its sediment, we now have four times the load of nutrients in the Mississippi River. So while we put the river back in our coastal basins for the sediments that we need, we're putting nitrate in those basins that could lead to hypoxia and harmful algal blooms and other deleterious effects in our food webs. So you're trying to rebuild these structures and rebuild nature under these artificial situations that really complicate what we're trying to do. So the solutions are tight. And in our case, the solutions are critical and urgent because of climate change. And I won't spend any time on these comments because everyone in this room knows those conditions. Second is the urgency of funding solutions. The largest source of funds for dealing with water Civil War projects are the Corps of Engineers. Unfortunately, priority setting is tied to a rudderless system for allocating funds and assessing national need. And it's this difficulty that we have of setting national policy, which really drives our inability at the local level of dealing with these crises, because now we're reacting instead of being proactive, until we have a national policy that can do this. In recent years, members of the House and Senate have tried to establish a needs-based approach for allocating funds, but the efforts have failed because too few members were interested in giving up the benefits of selecting projects on their political merit. Third is the urgency of coordinating solutions. And the challenge here is not only the fact that you can find solutions, you can fund solutions, but you have to coordinate solutions. And the challenge there is because of governance structure. Governance structure today at the national level to help projects like we have in the Mississippi River Delta just don't work. And until we can find ways that we did when we built the Mississippi River for navigation and flood control under Mississippi River Tributary Act, under a large body such as the Mississippi River Commission, which had one purpose, one entity, one funding source, a very comprehensive program, extremely successful, and now we compartmentalize all of our solutions and none of this is able to accomplish. So my final point again is the fact that what you find that when we get into these situations that we're reacting to, trace it back, and I guarantee you, such as in Everglades and in the 1935 hurricanes, an entire water control structure system that was built there, our case after 1927 flood, trace it back and you will find the key decisions that are made in a reorganization phase that is built and centered around hardening landscapes, engineered landscapes, and civil infrastructure relative then and without an appreciation for them, what natural resources provide is a source of your conflict. How we change that in the future, we're dealing with that today. I don't have all those answers, but that is essentially the point where we'll define who we will be 50 years from now. Thanks.
Thanks, Robert. Dr. Fischhoff.
Okay, thank you. Welcome to Pittsburgh. It's not so bad. It's actually pretty good, thanks to people like Mayor Fetterman and others, and getting better. So I was trying to think about how I could say something responsible about all of human psychology in five minutes, and I was reminded of something that Herb Simon, the late Herb Simon, a long time Pittsburgher, used to say, which is that human behavior, that people follow simple rules. Unfortunately, there are a lot of those rules, and their application isn't entirely predictable. So that if you know the science of human behavior, you can make better predictions. You can rarely make confident predictions. So looking for any sort of silver bullet or even silver buckshot in terms of bringing people along, it is unlikely to work. So the question is, well, what are the rules that we might apply to designed and evaluated solutions that would help to make the things that you all know matter to individuals? So I thought of three rules that might be part of the solution. This is at the individual level. There's another set at the group level and at the political level. So the first is that sustained behavioral change, which is what we're being called for here, involves both the heart and the mind. So psychologists call these dual process theories, and we study how sometimes the heart leads and how sometimes the mind leads. But if people are really going to change, you've got to get them both in sync. And one of the surprising things that's been coming out of psychological research in the last 20 years or so is you often think of emotion as being as undermining rational thought, but actually emotion has been found to have an important orienting and mobilizing property. So, for example, when people are angry, they tend to have more hope than otherwise. Kind of mobilizes them, they're more optimistic, they stay on the task. When people are passionate about something, they stay with tasks even when they're unreasonable. And it seems to me that you all know things that ought to make people mad, and that also ought to make people passionate by seeing the world the way you see them without trying to persuade them. So you've got some of the best material in the world. So I think just telling the story about what grabs you ought to be very effective without people thinking that they're being manipulated. Secondly, that people have difficulty absorbing information that they can't easily integrate with their existing beliefs. And we've actually heard some excellent examples. Here are properties of natural systems that are just unintuitive. So things like people have difficulty simulating in their minds nonlinear processes. So if you have invasive species that grow, that expand in, you know, exponentially, at, you know, or in some way, people just can't intuit that, and you really need to run the numbers for them, just as you need to run the numbers for them about how the risks of unprotected sex mount up through repeated exposure. But once you run the numbers and you explain why it's unintuitive, they can understand it, just as they could understand some of the processes that you were doing. Our natural instinct is, as from the professoriate, is to say we've got a teachable moment. Let's teach people the curricular approach to things so that from which we derive our thinking. But the research finds that people can know the curriculum, they can pass the test, and still not have any intuition. So making contact with people's intuitions is one way to help them to make the world make sense to them. And third, if you want to extinguish one behavior, then it's important to reinforce another. So if there's something that somebody is doing that you think is bad, or something that you're doing that you think is bad, it's not enough to try to stop that behavior. You've got to give people something else to do. So if people have a profligate lifestyle, find some other lifestyle that works for them. So vegetarian epicure works for some people. We once spent half a year in Sweden and discovered that some of the Swedes have an aesthetic of buying a very few things that are really very nice, preferably made by hand by Swedes. But there are other Swedes who gave the foundations for H&M, which is probably the most, even more wasteful than the Gap in terms of clothing. So if you can figure out what it is that people ought to do, so the people who are making this mess, you know, find something else for their due. And an irony of the gusher that you've been dealing with is that one time BP tried to market itself and even made some attempts as beyond petroleum, as trying to be a company that would provide ways to provide the services that energy provides, but in some other way. And there was a little walk behind that talk, but they clearly neglected many other parts of their enterprise. All those people need to do something, need to find something else for them to do. So I think if we want to prevent or take advantage of disasters, then I think it would help to have more collaborations between environmental scientists like yourselves, who know what matters, and social scientists like myself, who can help to make that matter to people. So, thank you.
Well, thank you. There's a ton of food for thought in these opening comments, and in particular, I'm struck by the fact that these comments really forced me to rethink the mindset with which I came into this room an hour ago, thinking that somehow we as scientists have been trying to give warnings, trying to share our perception of risk, and somehow it's, as Cassandra's, we're not heard, and then the event, then the tragedy, then the catastrophe happens, and now they'll listen to us, now we've had our teachable moment, now they've learned, and yet each of you in several ways has highlighted the fact that policymakers, the political system, the social system, is not necessarily any better prepared to assess after a crisis or after the reorganization phase that Robert spoke of. So I wonder if I can start off your discussions with one another in thinking about what are these teachable moments after these events and how might we change our own responses to them in order to participate more fully in society's responses to them?
I'll start. Bill saw some things I was thinking about here, Laura, that there was David Lodge and Robert both talked about conflicts of natural systems with engineered systems for people. And there's room for optimism. We have learned. We are making progress. Engineers have learned hard lessons. Sustainability, thinking about environmental sustainability and sustainable aspects of design as part of the code of ethics now for the American Society of Civil Engineers. For civil engineers, professional civil engineers, we're incorporating that in our curriculum, our curricula, and so we're making some progress there. Yet challenges persist, and David talked about the Asian carp invasion of the Great Lakes. I know that under discussion there is reversing the Chicago River. Hard to imagine that happening, yet I know Robert's been involved with the Florida Everglades, engineering the Florida Everglades. That's a very large project that we as a society have been willing to take on for environmental objectives. I think reversing the Chicago River will be very difficult to do. It's a much smaller scale activity than redoing the Florida Everglades. So maybe I would ask David and Robert to comment on what do you think the factors are that govern our willingness to take on restoration of past errors. Certainly there are economic drivers in there, but in both the cases I just mentioned, there are big economic drivers, yet we're proceeding on one. Maybe we'll proceed on the Great Lakes, the Chicago River, but I don't know. David or Robert?
I'll take the first crack. All right, we'll go in order here. I think you're right. I'm actually optimistic in the long run, but I think the difficulty with sort of the reactive settings in which we often find ourselves, in the example I'm talking about and in other examples, those are the very worst possible times when, to try to get people to sit back and think about the long term. Because as soon as people are in crisis mode, and as soon as we ecologists often pipe in with diagnoses of the problem, and others respond from different perspectives, and the public discussion gets polarized, then the opportunity for long-term, reflective, collaborative planning is difficult to recapture. However, in the Chicago Area Waterway, I am optimistic in the long run, because I think this has prompted a number of people to come together and recognize we do need a long-term solution. We do need to re-engineer the waterway in some way. And in fact, reflecting on one of Brooke's comments, I think the notion, to paraphrase his sort of third recommendation, as we need to provide an alternative, I think that's going to happen. By bringing parties together, I think we could solve a lot of Chicago's problems, problems that were initially prompted the construction of the canal, solve invasive species problems, and help the economy of the Chicago area with a new green multimodal transportation system. So I think we need to provide an alternative. We need to be willing to work with other parties and stakeholders to find long-term solutions. But it's really hard to do that when you're in the thick of reacting to an immediate, urgent problem.
Well, I have guarded optimism. It's we actually ask ourselves sometimes, how do we get up in the morning and after four hurricanes and this one gusher? And you have to have some sense of optimism. And I think it's really because what the situation, you have to make it real. Restoration is a term that we have some problems with, because it sets a level of expectation that we just cannot achieve, if purely in the context. And in fact, one of the major messages that we have out right now about our restoration program is that we cannot bring the Delta back to 1865 or even 1947 or 27. But the most important part of what we're trying to achieve is a known footprint of the natural setting, that which you can then organize all the industry and engineered infrastructure around it. And everyone needs to have a vision of what that looks like. And that vision has to be driven by the same processes that got you there, and that's the economics, public safety, and public good. And until you fit in with what you're proposing relative to the threats that any one of those parts of the formula, then you're immaterial. You're on the periphery. You're just not part of the dialogue. So what we find right now, our 900-pound gorilla is navigation. I mean, it is a huge. It's. I mean, it everything up in this part of the world goes out to international markets through the Port of New Orleans, which is the largest port by tonnage in the world. And so whatever you do with the river has to be associated with what the future goals are in navigation and flood control. If you look at what's interesting, if you look at the one outlet along the Mississippi River that was maintained, over James Eads, he didn't even want this outlet. It is the Old River Control Structure, which flows into the Chaffalai River, which is the one place along the coast of Louisiana that is presently building a delta. So it's an example of where flood control and navigation actually has an active building delta. So what you do is you take those analogs of the landscape where you have built compromise, even though it's serendipitous, and you use it to build a common vision for the future. And if we can put, because it amazes me, when we talk flood control and navigation, people build big projects. When we talk restoration, they want to put rock on a shoreline. And it's that imbalance between the scale at which you're willing to manage a natural resource to achieve a certain goal between navigation and flood control to restoration is bringing that balance back to where we're all at a scale that you can actually do something. My final comment is that what has brought us together, and why I think there's a certain optimism, is that I think every industry and everybody who has something at stake in the Delta knows they're going to lose it. There are no winners. Industry navigation knows that navigation 50 years, when they lose that intercoastal waterway to climate change and sea level rise, it's a whole new ball game. And those were not built for barges when you have tidal currents. And so everyone's going to lose. And so when you get into that statement then, you know, in that condition, then that's just because the signal now that we're dealing with, environmental signals, are so much larger than they were. And that is actually, we're at a point that we have to step up, and that's my point about solutions. Because it's not just telling them what we're doing wrong, but finding those analogs that actually people can focus on and where everyone can go jointly in the future.
Robert, that common vision that you mentioned, is that achieved with the Everglades? Is that did that help move that forward, or is that still?
No, I don't think so. I think that's why you have litigation. you always have stakeholders and certain parts of those at stake have something at stake that feel like they're losing something, and it'll take you to court over it. And you know, we've saw that for our oyster fishermen over the Carnarvon River diversion. We went to court, and the judge said, ruled over the public good versus the personal interests of the oyster industry. And it is going to take the courts to figure out what is the public good in some of these projects relative to, you know, what is the personal economic interest of a select group. And of course, land ownership. You know, most of 90% of our coastal zone is privately owned. So we have huge real estate issues when we start to wanting to do something with the river, let alone the industries that are surrounding. So it really, you know, that public good litigation and how stakeholders, and not all of them are going to agree, but then you have to bring in other ways of doing it, like a midnight, well, the Everglades, it was a midnight bill to move, relieve the environmental standards and get the bridge built down. And some of the Everglades people can talk about that.
Baruch, do you have anything to offer to this?
I would just say that I realize that an interesting tension that we have in many of these big plans is to get them technically sound tends to exclude the public. And there's a natural tendency to get all the technical details because you don't want to reveal something that might not work. And then you've got all of these stakeholders who have access to the decision-making process. And you can end up losing the vision and hitting the public cold with something that hasn't been sold. And sometimes you have design, you have freedom in your design where you could accommodate a broader section of the public. And you don't really have technical reasons for doing it one way or the other. So I think of the mess that we've had with healthcare reform and the climate change legislation, the energy legislation, which have gotten very, very nerdy, you know, with in a way that nobody could really, and hardly anybody could really, you know, could really found that where the public was really left out as people jockeyed for, as the insiders jockeyed for position, even the insiders who are friends of change are fighting the different ways of doing cap and trade, so somebody can really predict how these different mechanisms are going to work. And if these are going to require large scale public mobilization, then the public should not be left out of all of them. And it's striking that with healthcare reform, how easily it was to depict that to make the charge of death panels from something that had a very different, you know, and you could have anticipated that happening. Nobody thought about that happening. None of the cost-effectiveness analysts thought that with a minimal additional investment that they could have made this the Patient Information Act, that you could have put in the hands of patients authoritative information about the costs and the effectiveness of different healthcare measures. So instead, it looks like a command and control thing. So I think leaving the public out until we're technically satisfied may mean that the technically competent solution is not politically feasible. And I think that, you know, just as, you know, the, you know, the, your example of reasoning by by analogy. You can explain these things to people if you take the time to figure out what's really important and do a little bit of research on how to make things comprehensible.
The issue of engaging the public in discussions of these risk assessments and the appropriate social response to them is one that I've heard a lot of discussion about recently, and particularly focusing on the concept that there is not just one big amorphous public, but that in fact there are many audiences out there, each of whom may be hearing very different things with the same set of language or the same examples or the same approach, and each of which has a different set of reactions or maybe a different approach to effectively engaging them. Can any of you speak to the variety of publics out there with respect to some of the issues that you deal with?
I can give an example, a real-time example, right here in western Pennsylvania. Pittsburgh is often referred to as capital of Appalachia. So you're square in the middle of coal country here. You're square in the middle of natural gas country too. And we have a boom in natural gas development ongoing in the Appalachian region that is related to new technology to extract natural gas from deep shales through a process called hydraulic fracturing. So these are 5,000, 8,000 feet deep shales. They're relatively impermeable, so they haven't been exploited much. There is gas there, but now you can take a well down, turn it horizontally, run out several thousand feet, fracture the shale, and collect the gas. And there's a great deal of that activity ongoing here, emergent. And this is a very large new natural gas source for the nation, tremendous economic forces behind it. But there are environmental problems associated with it, and one of them is when you hydraulically fracture by sending down an aqueous suspension of sand and 50 plus chemicals for various kinds of engineering purposes, that water comes back up with all those chemicals along with brines from these ancient marine shales, and you have water that is seawater to 10 times seawater in concentration. That water is being managed in various ways here. Some of it was being discharged directly through publicly owned treatment works, which elevating the total dissolved solids levels of a river as big as the one out the back door here. Actually, the other river, the Monongahela, where much of this was taking place. And there are public meetings underway right now to talk about what kind of regulation should be put on this activity. So you have in the room people making the jobs argument, big new economic opportunity argument, reviving little communities out in the boonies that used to be a lot of coal activity where there isn't coal activity anymore. You have the environmental groups raising concerns about the water issue I mentioned, air emissions. And so the public is actually here, many diverse interests, economic interests. Oh, and by the way, there are these the drilling takes place on private property where leases can generate a lot of income for farmers and people out in areas where there's ready access to these resources. So the public is a very diverse group, and it's difficult to bring those together. We're in the middle of that right now, and most environmental issues have those that multitude of voices. But there's a real-time example going on here right now, and well, you're here in the next couple of days. If you pay attention to the newspaper, I'm sure you'll see something about it because it's in the paper every day.
Other examples of differences in risk.
Yeah, a slightly different example. David's offered a multitude of voices example, which you know is probably typical of most complicated issues because there are many legitimate, understandable perspectives. However, I can provide a counterexample, which I think is also not all that unusual, which is a few months ago, sitting in a room like this in the Chicago EPA building with a bunch of federal and state officials on the dais, and to talk about the Asian carp issue, and 99% of the audience represented one sector of society, which was the navigation industry. That was unrepresentative, but it's often it's unrepresentative slice of society, but it's not unrepresentative of the way that our politics works.
Interesting case.
Yeah, I let me pick up on that. There's two aspects about these kinds of issues. One is, from my own personal experience, one is it's fairly straightforward identifying the various groups that have something at stake, right, in the landscape of coastal restoration of the Mississippi River Delta in our case. You know, there's those who have economic interests, there's a cultural interest, there's people who live there, and then there's sort of the moral aspects of this eighth largest delta in the world going underwater. But there's what I find that's we're sort of, since Katrina, someone mentioned to me that we're sort of gone through planning fatigue. If we have to go to another planning meeting, you know, we're just that we're not going anymore. That's it. Mm-hmm. And so really, I guess my point is there's two parts of the formula. Number one is identifying those groups so that you have the balance. But it's the key now is how do you really structure the dialogue? And structuring the dialogue has two points to that. One is so you don't get in a situation where you're reacting and all of a sudden you don't have a balance of actually of the interests and the voices and the discussion that you need to have, but you structure them through IRS as a framework development team. We have a governor's commission, and I'm sure all of you interact with different commissions and groups that represent various stakeholders in your own region. But what we also found is that what we spent a lot of our time talking to the groups is about what we wanted to do without really firmly establishing a vision of what we all wanted and then figure out what we needed to do. And so we've sort of gone back and taken a step back. I wasn't a big proponent of this, but now I'm starting to see it work a little bit, and I think that's very helpful. But my third point here is that don't think that just because you set all this up, what I just described, that it's going to work. I spent first 5 years in a planning process for the Mississippi River Delta, and I probably talked to navigation once during that whole time, the largest stakeholder. So you actually have to force the issue with your largest stakeholder to come to the table to actually have a discussion, no matter what the climate may be to do that, whether it's a meeting up in Washington or wherever. But, you know, because they have, that stakeholder has such power and influence that it really isn't really worth the time and effort to participate in your planning process. And so I think that, you know, that has to be a sort of a very strategic planning within itself or those entities that you're dealing with. And just because they're not there, they don't participate, doesn't mean they're not interested. They're watching every move you make.
Perspective.
And I think a rough reading of the situation here, Dave might correct me, is that basically there was no discussion until about 6 months ago, at which point the industry had already had a very large footprint of leases and starting in relatively very poor, uninhabited, lightly inhabited rural areas that were economically depressed, and it's kind of an interesting dynamic of what's being released in order to kind of forestall the wave of problem that may be coming their way. I mean, I think the point about the public is that yes, there are many publics, and each of these settings has a different political dynamic, and we talk about the public at our peril without a disciplined look at where people are coming from. It's just too easy to intuit what other people's desires are and what other people are able to do. There are people who are finding now. I recommend to anybody the surveys that are done by the Yale Group on the Yale Climate Group, which have looked at, done a very simple sectoral look at the American, the six Americas, they call it. But there's remarkably little data, or there are remarkably few data about the public and climate, for as important it is. It's really all people's intuitions about other people. And one of the things that they find is that even among people who are have very, very different public positions on climate, sort of everybody's in favor of conservation. I mean, everybody, if you just took a consequentialist position to where is it that we wanted to be and never mentioned the word climate, we might make a whole lot more progress than we are now, where people are really invested in doing things because of anthropogenic climate change. So it's kind of remarkable the extent to which we fly blind on places where the public is really important. We know nothing about what the public thinks about terrorism, despite the billions of dollars going to the Department of Homeland Security. We know precious little about what the public thinks about climate change, certainly at the level of the kind of detailed solutions that we've been talking about here.
If I could just follow on to that, we need new ways of talking to one another. I think there are groups around the country working on that. At Carnegie Mellon, we have a group actually out of the philosophy department with a project called Deliberative Democracy that brings together stakeholders in a more systematic process of making sure people have the same information. Rather than just throwing it open to a public meeting, let people scream at each other and news media standing outside fanning the flames. I think we need new ways to communicate and try to hear each other's message and resolve differences. And there is work going on to try to identify some new models for that.
Well, speaking of new ways of talking to one another, this is the point at which we'd like to open it up for questions, comments, reactions from those of you here this evening. We have one microphone in the center of the room. So I and the panelists here would like to welcome anybody who's brave enough to open another line of discussion here.
What you outlined requires new forms of training for all of us that are in this room. Because engaging with different stakeholders that don't share our language, don't share our attitudes, requires a whole lot of humility, but also ways of learning to interact with each other. Maybe you can have some thoughts about that.
Well, I tell you my learning curve. This all gusher. The Monday before the Horizon, Deepwater Horizon blew, I took 50% of my time as on leave from LSU to be the senior science advisor to the governor's office of coastal activities. And I should have put an oil gusher clause in my contract. It is a tremendous learning curve. I couldn't agree with you more. And I guess that, you know, it's and I guess in my own conscience, the thing that you have to do is you really have to understand what the other side is saying when they speak, and listening, and that value of listening from their perspective, and then trying to actually build a certain trust, even though you disagree, and you have different value systems, you have different perspectives. You still have to come up with an answer that doesn't alienate the dialogue, because then you both lose. There's no way to moving forward in that dialogue. And then sometimes you feel like you've compromised your science and your training because what you said may be a little bit of a deviation from what you really wanted to say, but you maintain that dialogue to actually go on to the next step. So that's just my own personal training, is that sort of conscience in keeping the trust, being honest, but always in a conversation, thinking of the next conversation that maybe you can bring that you know, very different perspective to some closer perspective for a solution, and without compromising the you know, the Academy of Science and Engineering. And of course, when you're in the middle of an org gusher and your government wants to build sand berms, it gets really tricky. But that's my perspective.
Lou Gross, National Institute for Mathematical and Biological Synthesis. So this is a comment about the people who actually have the ability to link to people's hearts and minds. They're called politicians, and they actually are another species, it seems to me, at times. And I think we've done a very sucky job as ecologists reaching out to politicians in an effective way, finding out who's going to be the leaders of the future and engaging them and understanding what evidence-based science is about. And certainly, as Professor Tully is aware, if it weren't for the Clinton administration, there would be no Everglades restoration, because Clinton actually did it. He forced the issue to occur. So my question to you all is, how do we more effectively reach out, not to the general public, who frankly I've given up on, but to the politicians who may be able to move the general public forward?
I'll venture part of the response, but I want first to say I have not given up on the public. But secondly, I guess my own experience, and others may have better, broader, deeper experience than I do, trying to connect with policymakers and politicians, is it just takes an endless amount of time and patience and just willingness to keep the conversation going with staffers and members of Congress or whatever level of government the issue is that you're working on. And that also is not something we're trained to do as scientists. It's not something we're particularly rewarded for. It's something, if we want to have an impact, we simply have to slog through it. And persistence and consistency seems to me are keys. You can't make a visit and walk away and think anything's going to happen.
Yeah, I would second that. Willingness to engage and stay engaged. You know, David's working on the Asian carp in his neck of the woods. In your region, there's some issue like that. And you can send him a copy of your paper or go for one time to, you know, give 5 minutes of remarks, but you have to be willing to engage with the groups working on the solutions and stay engaged. As David says, you don't get rewarded for that professionally, maybe, but that's part of the personal, there's a lot of personal satisfaction and reward to come from staying engaged.
Yeah, Lou, I've moved about as close as you can into the politics and policy, and I tell you, I got too close, and because it's a tricky situation, but what I would frame it is three categories. There is a general public, and there are politicians, but then there are people of power, or people of influence, and there are what I call champions. And those champions are really critical, because they usually they're in office longer than someone of 4 years or 6 years, and I'll go ahead and tell you personally, one of ours in Louisiana is King Milling, former president of Whitney National Bank. He's part of the family of New Orleans. He's one of the most striking, sort of political figures, if you will, even though he doesn't hold political office, but he has the ear of business, of industry, and he really understands the economic consequences. And when you find someone like that and spend time, it took a lot of time and effort for us to sit down to sort of work through a trust and a dialogue. And that probably has been, and there are three or four others like that. And I think that is a really important investment. And I think, through him, hopefully I'll survive longer than I will with our present administration.
One more question. Frieda Taub, University of Washington. I wonder if working with the insurance companies wouldn't be useful. If they would offer cheaper insurance for a company that has good maintenance on their pipelines or valves or protection against leakage during floods, that would be an economic incentive for companies to do things better. And insurance companies understand risk.
Comments?
I would say insurance companies, my experience is they understand actuarial risk. They have a lot of difficulty with this kind of complicated risk, and they're really, they're kind of hard people to work with. Unfortunately, they're hard people to work with, even though they have a lot of those. Yeah. And okay.
I will say that a long while ago, I was part of the Southwest Region climate change workshops that were going on in a sustained way. And they were meant to engage stakeholders in a broad way, and there were similar regional groups elsewhere in the country. And I was struck by the fact that it was insurance agencies and the state's risk management pools and the water utilities that were much more willing to think further out than were some of the more natural, I would have said, natural resource or research agencies in the area. Because at least, you know, they're willing to consider the possibility of some of these catastrophic events and protecting themselves.
Can I make one quick comment? Three areas of insurance, we've dealt a lot with this in the Delta, and there's three very different perspectives there. One is your state commissioner of insurance, you know, in our case, runs for election. So, you know, that kind of insurance discussion is all about politics. But the underwriters, you know, the reinsurance agencies, the ones that actually are the ones footing the bill for these major calamities, those are the ones that really listen. They're doing the climate change research. But then what I found was very interesting in the Delta is that most of the big industries are self-insured. So they don't even respond to, you know, but the beauty of that is that they know risk and they're calculating risk. And so, you know, the loss of wetlands and all the underground pipeline is going to be exposed and all those risks, you can talk to them directly. You don't have to talk to an insurance company. So, you know, that some industry, it's even better to have them under a self-insured situation.
So we have reached our time of 6:30 and the social beginning outside. And I know we still have questions. We've got some very willing and engaged panelists. So I'm going to invite Mary Power to come back up here to close the session. But I hope that if you're interested in following up on some questions, that maybe we can ask our panelists to hang around for at least a few moments or to visit with us out in the social. I'd like to thank you again for coming, and I'd like you to help me thank our panelists for tonight's discussion.
Well, I want to thank Laura for organizing such an amazing symposium, and thank David, Robert, and Baruch for teaching us what it's like to be on the front lines of these major major crises that our society deals with when the environment's disrupted, and for Baruch in teaching us how we might more effectively communicate what ability we have to help with these issues. And so thank you all very much. I'll ask for another round of applause. Great. And you might be able to snag some of these folks in a reception. There's a reception outside the ballroom now. And so welcome to the meetings, and let's put our heads together and figure out how to deal more proactively with what's ahead for us. Thank you.
Thank you.